Hi, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf, and welcome to my podcast, Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. As a scientist, every new discovery comes from standing on the shoulders of the giants who came before us. Today, we're going to talk about the story of the maverick scientist Candace Pert, one of my giants, whose groundbreaking research and book, Molecules of Emotion, introduced the world to the mind-body connection, opioid receptors, and peptide T. I talk with the brilliant Pamela Rickman, who's a journalist, author, and producer, about the book she's written about Candace Pert, called Candace Pert, Genius, Greed, and Madness in the World of Science. We talk about Candace Pert's incredible groundbreaking research, about being overlooked for a well-deserved Nobel Prize, and her fight for recognition in a toxic healthcare system dominated by males, and how this backfired. We dive deep into the public healthcare system that isn't always as healthy as it seems. So let's begin. Pamela, I have been so looking forward to this interview. You're phenomenal. I have read the book Candace Pert. You can hold it up there. I've left mine in Miami, but I can hold it up on my phone. I have read this book from cover to cover. I have listened to, I think, every interview you've ever done, just about everything, not just about Candace Pert, but your work in general and what you've done for women. It is an honor and a privilege to interview you and to talk about what is probably one of the most important things that we can talk about, and that is what's happening in mental health, the health profession, and you know how women get overlooked in research and science and all these amazing things. So welcome to my podcast.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. And more than any, just about anyone, I was thrilled to talk to you because I have followed your work and your podcast, and I just feel like you and Candace are spiritual sisters. So this is, you know, and I came to Candace because of my profound interest in mind body, you know, in integrative health, in holistic health, in the mind body connection. That's how I discovered her to begin with. And that's how I discovered you. So now this feels like it's coming full circle and I'm so excited.
Oh, I'm so excited too. Well, one of my dreams was to meet Candace, and I was so sad when she died in 2013, only at the age of 67. And I think it's a death that probably could have been avoided, according to her primary care physician when I read in your book, and I didn't know those details. So there's incredible details and things and a journey of, you know, a real hero's journey and the ups and downs and the reality of good, bad, and the ugly. And we're going to discuss that and dive into that. And one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this is I have quoted Candace Pert. I showed you at the beginning. I've got this book that I'm almost embarrassed to hold up, but it's one of the, I think it was amazing. The second book I published back in 2005. Third book that I had published. And I quoted Candace there, and I was giving a lecture, and I came out the lecture. My husband had been to Barnes & Noble while he was waiting for, had been a part of the lecture, but for some reason had gone to Barnes & Noble's quickly, found this book. He was looking for something else. And as he came to collect me from the lecture hall, he said, "You've got to read this book." And I devoured it. I think that entire weekend, I just read her book. So he said, this is what you've been saying for the last like 10 years. And you know, and it's true. I had been teaching this all over the place. I had been told by the spiritual side of the world that I was a woo-woo new ager. I'd been told by the scientific community you can't combine these things. I'd even been told by my neurology lecturer, because I did a degree that was a combination of medicine and neuroscience and in the early days back in the 80s. And I'm just saying all this to give you a foundation very quickly. Yeah. But I remember being in one neuroscience lecture and we were being told that the brain couldn't change. And I remember saying, hey, that's not true. The brain must be able to change because our mind's changing and we're different and the mind changes the brain. And I'm sure you're aware that in the 80s, they still believed that the mind was and the brain was separate but worked together.
Of course.
Now it's seen as one. Now the mind and brain are seen as one, which is totally incorrect because it's mind, brain, and body. And he basically said to me, oh, well, you know, sort of writing me off as a female student in science, and said, well, oh, go do research. So I said, okay, what area? And he said, traumatic brain injury. And I said, okay, well, why that specifically? And he said, well, there's no research on it because there's no point in researching the brain's damage. Why bother, you know, doing
oh my
any
goodness.
Research?
How short-sighted. It's amazing that this was, I mean, it wasn't that long ago.
No, this is in the 80s. And so this was late 80s. So I did some honors research and some master's research and eventually worked in that field and showed that, you know, with mind-directed input, you can change the brain, which was the birth of one of the initial research studies done in neuroplasticity. And I say all that to say that I honestly would go back to take patients and that had radically changed and go back to the neurologists and say, hey, look at this and look at the behavioral cognitive change. And they would say things to me like, oh, you were lucky. And, you know, I've had scientists sit across from me saying, you're not a scientist. I'm sitting doing research with clinical teams. And so I just wanted to share that as a foundation that your book grabbed me, the words you're saying, and I'm not going to talk much more at all. I'm going to try and keep quiet because I want to hear what you
No, I love think. This because you and Candace, I mean, you were both at the forefront and you were both saying things that were paradigm shifting, you know, and you were overturning, frankly, the reigning paradigm that had defined Western medicine since the 1600s. And we can do a deeper dive into that, but that is no small feat. So, I mean, it's stunning to me, as we talked about before, you know, that suddenly 40 years after you were saying this and Candace is saying this, Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score has now been on the New York Times bestseller list for years, and he doesn't name check her or you, but the reality is his entire book is built on the foundation of this work that, you know, that was being promoted by women 40 years ago.
Exactly. So with that beautiful intro, tell us a little bit about you, and then let's dive into why Candace grabbed your attention. I know it was the mind-body connection, but then you read a book, you wanted to do a movie, a production on her. Tell us that back end, who you are, what you do, the Seleta movement, and then let's dive through this in. It's just so much to unpack and such great information.
Well, thank you. I mean, this is really, I have to say, this was not how I was planning to spend the last 7 years of my life. I mean, this is truly a labor of love. And I absolutely fell in love with Candace. I mean, she was such a character, this incredible spunk. But as I said before, just briefly, I came to her through my profound interest in mind-body medicine. I knew I had been pursuing I'm a Reiki practitioner. I don't hang out a shingle, but I've sort of learned various techniques. I've received acupuncture for a long time. I've sort of, you know, come in and out of many different techniques, both Eastern and Western. And so I was curious to know, I knew they worked because I could feel them working on my body, but I wanted to know intellectually how the science worked. I wanted to know why. And a friend of mine, my old writing coach, introduced me to Molecules of Emotion, Candace's 1997 memoir. And at that point, I was a New York Times journalist. And 10 years ago, I'd published my first book called Stiletto Network, Inside the Women's Power Circles That Are Changing the Face of Business. And so that was a nonfiction book, another nonfiction book. Basically, I found an underground movement of women's dinner groups and networking circles that were changing the world. I mean, driving billions of dollars of transactions, corporate board seats attained, companies founded and funded, all as a result of genuine women's friendships. You know, there's a money trail and a history of transactions, but the relationships themselves were not transactional. They were deep friendships. So I jokingly told everyone that was a love story disguised as a business story. And so I think all of this, what they say is research is me search. You know, that I was always interested in the things that you write the books you need, right? And so when Stiletto Network came around, you know, 10 years ago, I was sort of at a point in my career where I had just had my third child. I was like, holy cow, this is so much harder than I thought. What was I thinking? You know, he's a beautiful joy and he's now 15, but this was like, you know, having three little kids was quite challenging while also trying to, you know, to succeed in my career. Good.
So I get it. Oh, so I know what you're saying.
I know. So I was sort of looking to other women to say, oh my gosh, how did you do it? What's your secret sauce? And I found that the secret weapon was the support and love of other women. And so, you know, then a number of years, within a couple of years, that book was optioned. I ended up working on film and TV projects, both in writing and producing capacities. And when I read Candace's memoir, I was like, holy cow, this isn't just research for my personal life. This is a film. You know, I was like, this is the main event. Her story initially struck me as, you know, Hidden Figures meets A Beautiful Mind. You know,
I love that. I love it when you say that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, then it ended up being parts of like Lessons in Chemistry, Breaking Bad, and then like Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, you know?
Everything.
Yeah. I ended up finding a story that I never expected to find, but it started out as this deep passion for the work that she was doing and also for, you know, the plight and the real situation of women in the workforce over the last 40 years.
So important. I know when I listen to your interviews and, you know, look at about the Seleta Network and just what you've achieved, and it's so true. It's It's the woman connecting together. It's the support of each other. It's getting away from that competition into enhancement. And that's something that you know, it's a word that I've used years for years. Competition drains our mind, brain, body, but enhancement, which is celebrating others, increases intelligence and all that stuff. And you demonstrated that with your work and with your network, which is just amazing. Okay. So let's dive into Candace became, you got a hold of her widower and you started trying to get the rights and then the whole story came out and you talk about molecules of emotion as a memoir, and memoirs generally people paint themselves in a different light to what the reality is. And she is a Candace Pert. Let's start with her accolades of how phenomenal she is and tell us the story. You know, Pamela, take it from whichever angle you want. It's just such an incredible story.
Well, you know, and again, I have to say, no matter what I discovered about Candace, you know, and there is the good and the bad and the ugly in this story for sure. I continue to love her and I want her to receive those accolades that you mentioned.
I really
want her to get her due because she changed the course of medicine. She really did paradigm shift in work.
She needs the Nobel Prize.
She does. You know,
really.
And she would have gotten one. You know, I mean, there are many examples of, you know, and we can get into, I'll talk about sort of who she is. I'll give an overview of who she is and sort of what she accomplished. And then we can sort of dive into the different, you know, the different avenues because she was, so Candace, I mean, like you, renowned neuroscientist and psychopharmacologist who I jokingly say that she was like a Forrest Gump type figure. She played pivotal roles in three major movements in American, not only scientific history, but in politics. So she stood at the dawn of three revolutions. One was the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. We could talk about her role in that because many people think it began in the 90s with Big Pharma, but it didn't. In fact, it began in the 70s. So that was one. And the second where she played a big role, she was working at the National Institute of Health at the time, and this during the AIDS crisis. And the third, of course, is the mind-body revolution, you know, which led to integrative health or functional medicine as we know it. That's really sort of the paradigm shifting work. But she was this scientific prodigy. You know, she was 30 or 40 years ahead of her time. What, you know, these ideas that she started preaching in the early 1980s are now completely woven into the fabric of our healthcare system,
exactly.
Or at least increasingly so. But at the time when she was espousing these ideas, she was laughed out of room. She was literally, you know, it was like she was practicing mysticism. I mean, it's such a similar experience to yours.
Yes, totally. Totally. Yeah. No, that's incredible. So there's three major revolutions, the opioid and the peptide T, which is that, you know, the Dallas, what's it? The Dallas
Buyers Club.
That script
is wrong. I can tell you how.
Okay. Tell us that. And then there's three major things in mind, body, revolution, often referred to as the mother of mind, the mind, brain, body revolution, which she so rightly should be because she did. She back in the 60s and 70s, Candace was changing the world.
Yeah, if we can start talk about the mind-body revolution for a second, because that is really where she did her most impactful work. You know, in the early 1980s, no one thought that stress could cause disease. No one thought that our mental or emotional states could influence our physiology. But Candace's seminal studies that she did in the early 80s demonstrated that rather than being a control center, as our brain was previously believed to be, the brain, in fact, works in concert with our endocrine system, our immune system, our gastrointestinal system, you know, it's part of our central nervous system to actually generate our thoughts and emotions that shape our entire reality. So if this is the case, as you've said in your work time and again, that means the mind is distinct from the brain, right? It means the mind is mobile. It's consciousness or intelligence that's distributed along this vast multidirectional highway carried by, as she isolated, neuropeptides that are diffused throughout the whole body at the molecular level. So she was basically saying, you know, at a time when people thought that our bodies, you know, that our bodies just existed to carry around our heads. No, in fact, consciousness resides in our body and our body and mind are one. Yeah.
Incredible. I just nod my head so much because it's, that, you know, I love the story. Maybe go back to that story of how she explains Descartes, which was, there was a whole compromise with the Pope and how we got to that mind, brain, body and how we landed up there. That's a great place to start because a lot of people are confused, not on my podcast as much because I explain mind, brain, body all the time. But that, I don't think that's a great story to tell that story of.
It, is a fascinating story, and it's one I learned in my research. You know, so, and here's part of the reason Candace, you know, what she was met with so much resistance, because she wasn't just pushing the bounds of her field. She was, in fact, refuting the reigning paradigm that had been established, as you said, by René Descartes, you know, who's the father of modern philosophy and science. So, and this paradigm had defined Western science for more than 400 years, you know, since the 1600s. And so, I mean, it is a great story. It's just so kooky. You know, basically at that point, Descartes wanted to dissect bodies. You know, he wanted to perform autopsies to figure out how, you know, how our bodies, how our insides work. But if that at the time was considered a sacrilege. So the Pope made a deal with Descartes that basically insisted that the head, that, you know, everything a neck up held man's inherent sacredness. And basically then the body was kind of a meat sack that you could cut up upon, you know, when it ceased to live. And so once the soul had departed, the body was fair game for science. And autopsy then wasn't a desecration. And therefore, when Candace was suggesting the body's innate intelligence, basically saying that the mind or consciousness is mobile and lives all, you know, lives within us, within our entire system, she was contesting the foundation upon which modern scientific thought was built, you know, and at that point, she was also stepping on a lot of toes because the NIH and all of Western medicine had been established in this very silo-based way. Like if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you're a virologist, you're not thinking about how disease manifests in the body in the first place. You're not thinking about the role of stress or cortisol or anything like that. You're just thinking about how to eradicate cancer, say. However, when Candace started saying that all of our systems were connected, she was proposing this absolutely radical interdisciplinary approach, you know, that related neuroscience, pharmacology, immunology, and virology at a time when most scientists never looked, or doctors, frankly, never looked beyond the confines of their narrow specialties. So what did that mean on a practical level? She was stepping on a lot of toes because because all grants had been established in a very silo-based way. Studies were established in a silo-based way. And she was coming in and sort of, you know, she had sharp elbows. She was a tough broad, but she was sort of, you know, she was saying, hold on a second, this Cartesian view with its rigid hierarchies and again, silo-based funding structure that discouraged collaboration and information among, you know, among different sectors was actually breeding insularity. It was breeding apathy from other doctors, and it actually wasn't putting forth good or correct science. So she was, I mean, this was incendiary stuff, you know, for any scientist, much less a woman 40 years ago.
Oh, so totally. And I'm laughing at the whole Pope
Descartes.
You know, the fact is also they said here, but he still dissected brains, you know, so there were still these then, yeah, you know, so there's just, and also the fact that it was two males that decided the future of, you know, and just, and as a discussion. You know, which brings me to almost like fast forward, you know, 400 years to how the DSM is set up. It was a bunch of people, mainly males, sitting in a room deciding what symptoms and then changing. And that's not how you do science. That's not how you define parameters that define people and human behavior. My entire career has been one of trying to help people be empowered to help manage and understand this mind-body connection and understand how life becomes part of you, drives you, and how you can manage that. You can't take your stories away. You know, so when I hear you, but you can change how they play out into your future and empower people as opposed to taking away that power and putting it in the hands of God-like people. Now, I'm all for medicine. My best friends are in medicine. Yeah. I did part medicine in the degree I did. So I'm not anti that. But what I'm anti is what you talk about is the philosophy, the underlying tenets that hold things back, that hold the advances in science back. And it, just look at our current issue, which I know Candace predicted. I was in a neuroscience lecture, in another lecture where they were talking about how back in the, this was about 82 or 83, where they were talking about, hey, this move to label ADHD and this move to label is going to be a huge problem in 30, 40 years time. Fast forward 30, 40 years later, it is a huge problem. It's a description. It's not a
right.
It's not a diagnosis. You know, there's just so many flaws, but those became almost like mythical statements. It became scientific fact that drove things. And so often patriarchally, that's such a word, driven, yeah. You know, So
it's true.
That's what Candace was facing, and she fought. And she was such, as you say, such a woman of courage, such a woman of character.
She really was.
And when she owned the game.
Yeah, to build on what you just said, I mean, when she was, because she really did, she was a scientist who merged science and spirituality. You know, as she progressed in her career and the older she got, she started to see the nature of her work as sort of, you know, as the individual, as a microcosm of the universe. She saw the connection between beings. She alienated a lot of her scientific peers by actually using words like God or soul or spirit,
yeah.
You know, in her work as she got older. But in that sense, she also, I mean, she knew she was, you know, uttering heresy on multiple levels. And the first is also allowing, you know, spirit to enter the world of science, saying that she did not, you know, her discoveries, her greatest discoveries felt like great downloads to her, spiritual downloads that they were given to her to sort of do good on the planet. And by the way, she wasn't alone in there. There's a whole history of hundreds of years of scientists who have cited their greatest discoveries to the hand of the divine. But in modern science, those words, I mean, she might as well, you know, have been locked up and treated like a crazy person.
Exactly.
And then I think the second way is exactly what you just said. She was undermining the demigods known as doctors. She was telling people spiritually that they had a personal connection to the divine that could be, that didn't need the church as an intermediary. And also that we had a personal responsibility in our connection to our health, our physical and mental health and emotional health, that didn't necessarily need the intermediation of doctors and big pharmaceutical companies, because she saw enough in her own work that not everybody had our best interests at heart, that ostensibly, you know, the Hippocratic Oath, "Do first, do no harm," was not always one in practice in the very sort of cutthroat environments of sort of where she was raised in Johns Hopkins, the NIH, and, you know, and then in venture capital funded business. So she was up against a lot of forces. She was, for sure.
She definitely was. And, you know, Pamela, she also saw what I loved about her as well, is she also saw the good side of medicine and how that was being corrupted by this, the way it had been distorted, and the drive for, I hate to say capitalism, but the drive, the Hippocratic Oath, which was not fulfilled. So that instead of just being out there to help people, it became, which is what she was very much about, that goal. And I know that she was also, she's been criticized for also helping herself, whatever, but that's another whole story which we can go into. But the fact is that we need medicine, and we need medicine to advance. And from what I understood, what she would say in her lectures and what you've written about her, she was saying this philosophy of very male dominated and silo dominated and financially dominated took the beautiful science that was there for humanity. The advance in AIDS. I mean, she fought to get people to, she wanted to help people, and she had to fight to get a drug into the hands of people that could help people. You know, and then people didn't listen to her about what she discovered with opioids. Maybe chat a bit about that, which I don't know where you would like to start, because it's just.
Well, I think a good way in is also sort of her mind-body research. And then I'll actually go, and then I'll go back to the opioid, because part of what
she. It's all mind-body.
And so part of what she observed, once she sort of proved the mind-body connection, she was observing that psychiatrists and psychologists were treating the mind with no regard for its effect on the body. And likewise, then, because of this silo-based structure in the NIH and all of Western medicine, physicians were treating the physical body without considering the impact of our thoughts and emotions, you know, with no regard for the mind. But Candace insisted that because they're obviously linked, they had to be assessed and addressed as an integrated whole. And yet she saw, I mean, largely because the tragic irony of her life is she was a neuropharmacologist who pioneered techniques that are still being used by the NIH and all of pharmaceutical companies today to develop and test the efficacy and dosing of drugs. She was really at the forefront and in part of a scientific lineage of Nobel Prize winning, field-defining scientists who were, you know, at the forefront of psychopharmacology. And yet she saw what happened, that psychiatrists and doctors suddenly became trigger happy when it came to prescription drugs. Instead, and this goes back to also part of, like, you know, our insurance practices, but yeah. instead of actually taking time with patients to unpack and figure out what was their core trauma, what was really at the heart of whatever, you know, they were suffering from, it was like, yeah, write a prescription, take a pill, fix your life. You know, it was the quickest fix possible. But Candace argued that psychiatric medications can mask the symptoms of disease while leaving, and also all medications, while leaving the underlying causes of trauma untreated. Like, you know, what she said also, like, she said that what we experience as reality, right, is constantly filtered through and regulated by our emotions. So the brain is in survival mode all the time. It's actually wired to make us forget or ignore many of this of the stimuli that are bombarding us every day, because it's basically just focused on how do you survive, right? Absorbing only what it deems necessary. But Candace talked about how so many emotions are sidestepped or sort of, you know, ignored by the brain and never even rise to the level of consciousness. So take a child, you know, but that doesn't mean they go away, right? There, I mean, of course, I'm preaching to the choir. This is absolutely what you know, right? These traumas, they can be stored at the body's cellular level, you know, deep within the roots of our neuropeptide receptors. But then as a result, like our bodies, we can still be operating in fight or flight and never really even know what's at the heart of that. I mean, especially, you know, she cited a lot of studies. She did a lot of studies on, say, children who had been emotionally abused or sexually abused, like before they ever had the context to understand what had really happened to them. And so they block or repress these memories that are too painful to process. But as an adult, their systems still stay in fight or flight. They still suffer the symptoms of insecurity and anger and stress and rage that actually has profound effects on all of the body systems, not just the brain. And so, you know, I mean, Candace was saying that, you know, medications can mask the symptoms of depression and other illnesses, but they don't get to the root cause. And if body and mind are one, cooperating in this fluid, you know, ever evolving intelligence, then we are all beholden, the medical system, and we as individuals are really beholden to get to that root cause. And not, you know, pills are great, but they should be used to sort of augment natural medicine as opposed to replacing it entirely. And so that was, I mean, a lot of her legacy is that message. And I think that that message is one that still needs to be heard, you know, shouted again from the rooftops all over, even if a Western medicine. Because we do have a tendency, in my humble opinion, to overprescribe, and that is actually also a great way into her role in the opiate crisis, because she played a pivotal role there, and it is this sort of overprescription that we are still dealing with as a society.
You explained that so beautifully, and I cannot agree. I mean, it's just everything that I have been trying to talk about for years, and we just released a paper came out last week on our another paper on a clinical trial we've done and work we've been doing in psychoneurobiology, showing that you know that this what we know now. I mean, it's from the sort of late 80s, early 90s, and on we've become more accepting. And as you say, but even so, in that journey, it's only really in the last, I would say, probably maybe 5 to 10 years that it's really been accepted that when people say something like "all in your head" is a negative thing. And back 30, 40 years ago, I was saying it is all in your head, but your head's not here. Your head is all over. You know, and the way I always explain it is it's mind, brain, body, psychoneurobiology. And the mind is that life force. It drives your mental. It drives your physical. So your brain and body just respond. But this conversation is going into the mind, brain, and body, three places as memories clustered into thoughts. It's trees in your brain. It's hedges in your body. We are building 37 to 100 trillion clusters of memories of this conversation as we're talking. And we're making millions of cells every second to be able to 800,000 to a million cells every second to cope with it. And each part is adding a different, you know, this is reality. I mean, we've shown in this paper we just published, we've shown how within, because I look a lot at habit formation and time and how the time it takes for healing to take place. And a lot of studies, as you know, because you've done the research, clinical trials are done over 3 week, maybe 6 week period. Very few longer than that. And it takes a minimum of 9 weeks before you're actually going to have a network change.
Isn't that amazing?
I know. Exactly. I mean, we've showed that when you manage your mind, you can change your telomeres in 9 weeks, which they used to think, you know, they shorten and then they lengthen in 9 weeks. They used to think it'd take 5 years. We've shown the homocysteine. We've shown, you know, we're trying to do direct research now, myself and my team. And what's interesting is people are listening because we're doing scientific research, we're publishing. But what's interesting is I'm not publicly funded. I'm a part of a university. And this is a decision I made 40 years ago, 35 years ago, under the advisement of my then professor, who I had two incredible woman professors who were my mentors and the PhD and masters, my MSc and PhD advisors. And they said to me, and I wish Candace had had this kind of advice, but these women stood up for me. And it was the 80s, not the 60s and 70s. So things had advanced a little bit, but they stood up for me and they actually would fight when I would go and give lectures. They would fight for me and say, hey, listen, we've got to open our mind to this mind, brain, body thing. And then they called me aside and they said, you know what? I had offers to run departments at big universities. They said, don't them. Go out on your own and do your own research. Get in the field, learn the system and dive in, work with people, which I did. I did for 25 years. I didn't publish for 25 years. I just researched. I dived in there. I didn't follow the publish or perish. And now in this latter half, now we're doing formalized science. And I am so grateful because I didn't get caught up in a system. We've managed to privately raise funds and do research. So we're not controlled by anything. And we are publishing in scientifically peer reviewed journals. But, you know, so I was lucky and it breaks my heart that Candace didn't get that opportunity, she had a lot of mentors that did help. But I mean, look at that soul, the guy who was going to take who got the Lackman Award when she should have got it and the Nobel Prize. Talk just maybe a little bit about that and how she just kept fighting that system quickly before you go into the opioid crisis. Yeah. Cause I'd love about that because people are not aware of that side of what she did.
Absolutely. And in fact, before I go into that, I just want to address something that you just said too, which is so important, which is the fact that even university research since the 80s has not been, you know, peer-reviewed, pure research that we thought. I mean, part of what was mind-blowing to me in my own research for this book, and I think, you know, that I learned, and Johnny, I will recommend to everybody also John Abramson's book. He's a Harvard professor, but a long-term family physician who's also been an unpaid, you know, advisor to the FDA and to the government in sort of a number of class action lawsuits and things that have happened. Because essentially what he describes is in the mid 80s, when President Reagan cut funding to the NIH and to federally funded institutions, as well as universities had to look outside for funding. And where did they get it? From pharmaceutical companies. But then what ended up happening was what we think of as sort of independent peer reviewed research became entirely corrupted by this sort of by goals and the direction of pharmaceutical executives. So the pharmaceutical companies started basically cutting the data. They would control, they realized that they didn't have to pay for the overhead at university institutions, that they could set up their own center called, you know, these CROs, these research organizations that they paid for. And so they would carry out the studies, but then they would cut the data. And they would cut the data in ways that was only favorable to what they wanted they wanted to achieve. That they would give that limited subset of data to academic researchers who then would write what appeared to be independent peer-reviewed research based on a totally corrupted data set. And those papers would then go into academic medical journals that all of our unsuspecting doctors were using to make treatment decisions for the public. And genuinely, this is how the opioid crisis and so many other crises happened. It happened because pharmaceutical companies were controlling the data and the FDA, in fact, the FDA, well, nobody else, none of our family physicians had access to the underlying data. The FDA always did. So I don't know who was sort of, you know, asleep at the wheel in the FDA. But the FDA could have known at any point that all of the, if they had looked at the data, the underlying data, that all of the claims being made about OxyContin's, you know, extended release and you only need half the dosage and all this stuff, they were absolutely patently false. And yet, you know, the Sacklers and Purdue were able to slap these labels on with completely false information that our doctors believed and our society believed. And this is, I mean, again, it's just, it was the absolute corruption of what should have been very pure studies and pure medicine because they were paid for by pharmaceutical companies. And so that, you know, God bless, hallelujah, that you went out on your own because, you know, I mean, you could have been doing this research and even inadvertently, a lot of the academics who were publishing these papers didn't realize that they were receiving, you know, corrupted, limited data sets. So that's a reality.
It's a reality and it's controlled. You know, you, once you're in that environment, you have to publish or perish. You have to get grants. You have to get tenure. You know, there's just so many. So the purity of science for the betterment of mankind and the purity of medical help for helping mankind, you know, has been lost and corrupted. And there's so many, I know, and I'm sure you do, interviewed so many amazing doctors. I've trained many physicians. I've moved into a lot. But there's this overarching core that is, and it's coming out more and more now. And so what we, you know, revere as Harvard, not everyone is corrupt at Harvard or MIT or obviously, but there is an underlying flaw that is running thread that is very strong, that is running through all these institutions that is a problem. And, you know, Candace was one of the few people to start fighting it. And, you know, you are among a few brave people that are revealing and talking about these things. And, you know, we need more conversations about this. We need that reality. We need to stand up and fight this and create awareness.
Well, we do. And you know, to your point, and also to your earlier question about Candace's early experience with her mentor at Johns Hopkins, this value system, this sort of absolutely cutthroat, you know, I win, you lose, you know, zero sum game, was really sort of part of the fabric of sort of hot science. You know, if you wanted to be a cutting edge researcher in that day, it was a predominantly male, you know, dog eat dog environment. And that's where Candace walked into. You know, she was such a pistol. She'd gotten accidentally pregnant on the laboratory floor at Hofstra University with her lab, you know, one of her lab mentors, Agu Pert, who became her first husband. And so she was a young mother. She was pregnant at 19, became a mother at 20, and still managed to sort of apply to Johns Hopkins. She was initially, you know, to get her PhD, she, after getting a science degree, a biology degree at Bryn Mawr, she was originally rejected because she had a husband who was in the reserve forces and could be called to Vietnam at any time. So her interviewer at Johns Hopkins said, well, how could you possibly be a scientist? You know, your husband might have to go to war. You're a mother, you know, forget it. But then what happened was Candace wrote Saul. Saul was at the time the youngest full tenured professor at Johns Hopkins. He was considered a Wunderkind. As I mentioned earlier, he was in a scientific lineage. The whole concept of scientific lineage is fascinating to me too. Half of all Nobel Prize winners are quote unquote descended from other or trained by other Nobel Prize winners. So suddenly, and that was the case for Saul. His mentor had won the Nobel Prize, was Julius Axelrod. And Julius Axelrod's mentor was Steve Brody, who was really considered to be the father, the absolute founder of the field of pharmacology. So when Candace joined Saul Snyder's lab, and I say this in the book, she knew that she was entering basically a scientific, like a dynastic lineage. You know, she was getting keys to the kingdom. So she went in, you know, with stars in her eyes. She absolutely revered Saul Snyder. And what happened was, and she just longed to please him. She worshiped this man. And so initially Candace was, you know, I mean, she was impulsive. She was a wacky woman which made her charming and super fun, but she was a bit sloppy in the lab and she had that reputation of doing sort of quick and dirty work. So she was initially given, so Saul was worried she wouldn't get her degree. He gave her this boring acetylcholine assay to do. And she said, "No, no way! In the tradition of my scientific lineage, I want to do work that shapes mankind. I want to do work that really changes everything."
And she did.
But suddenly, what happened was when Richard Nixon—and this is so fascinating—like the intersection of science with politics and money politics. And power. I mean, it's a story. You know, I mean, it's a tale as old as time, right? About what gets, you know, where the funding go, you know, follow the money. And that's where the research gets done. So really, before Nixon entered the scene, nobody cared about drug addiction. Nobody cared about opioids or whatever. It was a very, very small group of researchers, even worldwide, who were looking into this at all. But suddenly, with the war in Vietnam, 25% of American soldiers fighting were addicted to a form of heroin that was 95% pure. Like, take street heroin here is 5% pure. So these were super addicts, and they were increasingly some of the carnage, the terrible things that American troops were doing abroad, like the My Lai massacre, were being on this epidemic of drug addiction. And the U.S., the U.S. population, the public, was increasingly turning against the war and increasingly concerned about what was happening with our boys overseas. And so essentially, Richard Nixon wanted to escalate bombing in Vietnam. And he thought that he could, that he could get the American public on his side if he could sort of claim credit for curing drug addiction. It was like, don't look over here. Well, I escalate bombing. I'm going to take credit for this. Like, it was a PR stunt. And so he poured millions of dollars into finding the cause of drug addiction. And suddenly this piqued Candace's interest, but it also piqued the interest of scientists, worldwide and particularly nationwide. They're like, where there's money and funding, there is attention. And then scientists see, an opportunity to make their name. And that's exactly what happened. Candace went to Sol Snyder, her mentor, and said, I want to do this, forget my boring essay. I'm going to take on, this huge problem of the day. And, Saul had been sort of thinking about this anyway. It wasn't entirely Candace's idea. He had been reading other scientists' research in this area, but he decided to, hey, okay, give it a shot. So after 6 months of failed attempts, Saul pulled the plug. He said, look, it's my job to make sure that you get a degree. You failed so far, and we have to get you back on track. So Candace sulked, and then she hatched a secret plan, which was to... This is such a Candace move. Because, again, Candace was going to do what Candace was going to do. And on some level, it takes that sort of, and I will stop for a second and just say, these same characteristics that are absolutely celebrated and lauded in men, which are sort of innovation. Yeah. This was like the Marlboro man, independence. I'm not going to be constrained by the rules, all this stuff. Suddenly, when men make the discovery, they are considered, well, he's tough because he had to be, he's a real innovator. He doesn't stand for any sort of bunk. When a woman does that, women have to sort of evince virtue and, good intentions or risk being shunned and sort of burned at the stake. And I think
that's literally what suddenly that Marlboro man in the woman, it's seen as something as a negative, totally negative kind of quality. And it is.
And Candace had a lot of those sort of stereotypically male characteristics. And that actually made her a survivor. There's a reason that she was able to succeed in these male dominated environments. But there's also a reason, and we can talk about this more after, but there's a reason that they sort of ate her up and spat her out too, and what does that mean for women going forward? That's another whole story to unpack. But, what ended up happening here with Candace is that she illegally procured, with the help of her husband, who was a scientist working elsewhere, she illegally procured radioactive material, snuck it into the lab, and her son, and there's a crazy story about her son's babysitter getting sick. So she sneaks in her son. Kids aren't allowed in the lab, much less like with radioactive material. And it's on a Friday night. She sneaks in, she waits till everybody else has left the lab, and she does this experiment. And it's not like she didn't have, today where you have computers and immediate results. She had to wait on pins and needles till Monday to sneak everything into the lab.
All the tops on the bottles, didn't she?
She had Evan, taking she had just sort of playing with little lab things. She's like, oh, sit on the floor, kid, and, occupy yourself. But she came back and it worked. Her technique worked. Not only to find the opiate, and, this is the chapter of the book it's Eureka. She has this, and I was able to see, from her widower this. He has the original, the original graph paper, the lab notebook that she kept. And on the bottom, she said, oh my God, it worked. Will it continue to work? I pray to the great God of science. Here was this. She was a 26-year-old graduate student making a discovery that scientists the world over were searching for. and that was absolutely, again, would redefine her entire field. And not only did she discover the opiate receptor, but also she pioneered this technique. The technique that she pioneered to discover that receptor was then universally employed in Saul Snyder's lab to discover all of these other receptors in the brain and body for caffeine, for cannabis, for, yeah. And so once scientists and doctors could figure out how our own endogenous chemicals worked, you know, our inside chemicals, how they fit, like, you know, I mean, the basic example is like a lock and a key. The receptors were the lock and our internal chemicals would fit in a key that they actually kind of vibrate and dance together and all this stuff. But if they could fit into these receptors and evoke chemical reactions, right? Then they could figure out, okay, these are how external drugs fit into these receptors. And then they could develop either more potent or more effective external drugs or exogenous medications that actually sort of led to a massive boom in pharmaceuticals.
She discovered, so for the listeners, a receptor is like a little doorway on a cell, and it used to be seen as a ligand, a lock and a key. And then Candace herself revolutionized that, as opposed to if she first used to talk about it, and then as she knew it, learned more, it became these not so much a lock and a key, but more these docking stations, and that every cell in our body, and we have 37 to 100 trillion, are covered with thousands of these little receptors that are waiting for waiting to recognize whatever they need come inside. And she discovered that, and she worked out the concept of psychoactive effects and, you know, how, you know, the opioid or heroin, the drug heroin. And her goal was to, and I don't mean to take this away, I'm just like reinforcing for what I know your story, and you beautifully elaborate on your story, but she was always trying to find ways of, if that's how it works, how can we then help the person who's got the addiction? Because as you painted the picture, this was during the Vietnam War, and yep. And the forces were battling with addiction to heroin, and she was looking for a way to stop that. But how her science was kind of abused, and it transitioned over, that same philosophy transitioned over into the AIDS story.
That's exactly right. When she was doing this work, she thought that she was going to come up with a solution. She was going to combat drug addiction. She was going to stop drug addiction.
And in fact, what
I say is, initially, that's what pharmaceutical companies moved to do. So 3 years after she discovered the opioid receptors, two scientists at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland discovered our body's internal chemical, which is, I didn't even know this, that endorphins mean endogenous morphine. Our body's internal high. Because they reason that, of course, these receptors hadn't evolved. Our body hadn't evolved to have receptors just for external drugs, like for heroin or something like that, right? We actually had to have something inside to justify the existence of a receptor. And so then when endorphins were discovered, and it was originally called enkephalins, so it was like a bastardization of a Greek term, in the head or something. Pharmaceutical companies moved to develop mimetics, basically, you know, drugs based on the chemical structure of endorphin. But they couldn't find something that basically was non-addictive, because it was like, our body is not addicted to our own endorphins. Let's find something else that can block the receptor, can fill that spot so the drugs won't get in, right? It's like closing the door on the drug. So the drug can't get in. And then, you know, and also like our own endorphins that our bodies will become addicted to. Well, pharmaceutical companies couldn't do that. They were unsuccessful. So they weren't going to make a mint on that. So what did they do? They went and developed even more potent analgesics. You know, it became, so what I say is, like, Candace was like, you know, Pandora, who opened the box to this entire world. But then she became like the Cassandra who was, you know, was warning, you know, the government, individuals, all this stuff against how her, like the new creator of like Oppenheimer, right? Creator of nuclear fish, you know, who comes to hate the bomb. It's like, you know, it's like this Frankenstein's monster situation where, like, what have I done? And I think she, you know, she was actually really one of the few scientists courageous enough to speak out. And again, this is when she doubled down on, she doubled down on her commitment to mind body work, because she was saying, hold on a second. We don't need all these external drugs. These are lining corporate pockets while actually ravaging this population that's desperate for relief. So, it's tragedy.
With summer just around the corner, I've been focusing on planning family get-togethers and outdoor events, And a major part of that is finding good quality food so my loved ones can share delicious meals together and make some amazing memories. This is why I'm a big fan of ButcherBox. They take the guesswork out of finding high quality meat and seafood you can trust with 100% grass-fed beef, organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. All of their products are humanely raised with no antibiotics or added hormones. ButcherBox's amazing food delivery service means less trips to the busy grocery store. I am always prepared with meat in the freezer and have curated tips and recipes based on my box if I need some mealtime inspiration. My husband and I personally am excited to get grilling with their incredible grass-fed sirloin steaks, pork ribs, pasture-raised chicken thighs, wild salmon, which make a great addition to all our outdoor activities planned for this summer. Not a fan of pork or beef? No worries. With ButcherBox, you can get just what you want delivered right to your doorstep with free shipping in the continent of the US and no surprise fees. And you get to choose from a variety of box plan options from curated to customized and change your plan whenever you want. Sign up at butcherbox.com/Dr. Leaf and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a special deal plus $20 off your first order. Join today using my link, butcherbox.com/Dr. Leaf, and use the code Dr. Leaf to receive this unique deal today. The link and details will be in the show notes.
It's a tragedy, and she was so right in her predictions of what psychotropics all the different psychotropic drugs. She predicts it. She said it's going to make things worse, and we have federal data showing that, you know, between 96 and 2014, and it's continued, that people are dying 8 to 25 years younger from preventable lifestyle diseases. And a lot of that can be, it's pretty much, that's the statement, but it can be tracked back to what Candace predicted, in that if we keep using it, it's going to create a distortion of the positive effect that the natural endogenous substances in our body can generate. And she was so right. You can't play with these things. You should use them if you have it, like an ibuprofen. If you have a headache, take an ibuprofen, but you don't chronically take ibuprofen in case you get a headache. You know, in that case, yes, it's going to have, because everything you think, everything you put in your body, everything that goes in, because an experience becomes as much part of your network as does something like an opioid or an ibuprofen or food that you eat. But to be aware of how you're doing that, managing that process. And that's not what the industry did. It was basically a pill for every ill, and it became a revolution in the wrong direction. I don't know. That's my opinion.
So, no, I mean, I agree. And I know Candace agreed. You know, she really did not like, and then, and again, adding insult to injury to talk about sort of what happened to her, to go back to the crazy competition. and really, you know, this was the man who had groomed her. And in some ways, in many ways, Candace worshipped him. And what I said was that, you know, in so many ways, she was like his perfect lieutenant until he crossed her. I mean, in some ways, you know, they had in publishing their study the way they did. They did not acknowledge the work of their forebears, which would have been really necessary, you know, not only generous, but was the custom and was necessary. Avram Goldstein was a scientist who had previously contributed so much to the field and really laid the groundwork for their work. Now, the way Candace tells it in her memoir is that Saul really instructed her to, like, no, let's cut them out. We are going to claim this win all for ourselves. You know, we are going to leapfrog to the finish line. And it's going to look like just us and nobody came before. I mean, like I said, this was a dog-eat-dog, tough business. And Candace was party to that. And she agreed, and she did his, you know, she did Saul Snyder's bidding. And then she herself got screwed. You know, because what ended up happening was Saul, you could say that Saul was quite generous and that he, you know, she was a young graduate student. And, you know, this is, a lot of people say this is how the game was played. He gave her the opportunity to sort of speak widely about this as a grad student, to make her own name. But when it came down to who was going to really get credit for the work in the form of the big prizes, he cut her out. And he did it purposefully. He claimed not to, but there was enough evidence that he actually did. So what ended up happening was Saul had this, because prizes are generally conferred, you know, after a number of years, after the research has been replicated and peer reviewed and all this stuff. So right when Candace had made her discovery, it was a huge sort of press event, because Richard Nixon wanted to take credit, but then the NIH, which was under, felt like the Nixon administration might be taking their funding. So then they wanted to take credit. Johns Hopkins wanted to take credit. You know, there were all these people sort of you know, involved in the land grab, right? So Candace did get a lot of press at that time. But then it kind of died down. People start looking at other things. Saul helped Candace and her first husband, Agu, get plum jobs at the NIH. These were very hard to get. She was there. She was, you know, safely ensconced working at the National Institute of Mental Health there with Agu in the next office, running a ground, continuing to run, you know, do groundbreaking research, run a lab that was absolutely thriving. When she got word from one of the scientists at the University of Aberdeen, she thinks now that she cast it as sort of a warning that he came to tell her that he and his boss, John Hughes, and Saul Snyder have been nominated for the Lasker Award, which, for those who don't know, is America's highest scientific honor. And often the people who win the Lasker go on to win the Nobel, or at least be sort of in the running. Mm-hmm. And at first, I mean, Candace even talks about this in her memoir, how, and I talked to Agu, her husband, about it, you know, how naive she was, how she just couldn't believe it, because Saul was her, this was like, he called her his little girl. This was like, this was her, the man she loved most outside of her husband and all this stuff, who had paved her way to greatness. And she couldn't believe it until she got a personal invitation from him inviting her to sit in the audience at the luncheon where he would be awarded. And at that point, I think it sunk in, and it was just, he had gone too far. And this was an experiment that he had tried to abort. You know, exactly. He's done a lot of the thinking. He should, you know, I mean, he deserves credit for shepherding her, for being
joint prize. They needed to get it jointly with Goldstein.
Yeah.
It could have been all three of them.
But the problem is the only three people, so it would have had to before, because it would have been, you know, had to have been the two from Johns Hopkins, Saul and Candace, and the two from University of Aberdeen. But only three people can be nominated for any one thing for the Nobel Prize.
It's true.
So Saul was going for the Nobel. He was absolutely rabid for the Nobel. And he figured, who is easiest to kick out? Oh, the woman, the youngest one and the one. Even though, I mean, it was Candace who did all the work. And arguably she held the same position as the junior scientist on the other paper. So that's what she reasoned. She ended up, you know, going to the press, particularly to sort of female journalists who would understand her plight and fight for her. And there was a big brouhaha in the press. But as a result, Candace's reputation as a scientist never really recovered. Because, I mean, she was branded. She called herself the Scarlet Woman of Neuroscience.
Yeah.
Because at that point, you know, it was disgraceful that not only she would speak out against her mentor, but also that she would sort of reveal the dirty, messy inner workings of a field that was ostensibly, you know, ruled by reason. We're supposed to be untouchable. How dare you pull back the curtain and show that we're all sort of nasty fighters underneath? You know, I mean, she really, it was a doozy, wasn't it? She did it, you know, on behalf of herself. I initially, having read her memoir, was like, I love this like feminist icon story. And then, yeah, the truth was a little more complicated when
I'd love you to talk about that. Let's just talk quickly about the peptide T, who worked there as well, because I'd love people just to hear that, because it's really also the way that panned out was just another horrible story.
This is another
good
horrible.
And bad.
It's true. I think it's illuminating, and it's actually a window. This is also one of the great joys and also, you know, further tragedies of this book, is that I got to talk to scientists who are now in their 70s, 80, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, their careers, I mean, they're either retired or retiring. And so
they
another
say,
of them, they basically said, well, I don't have anything to lose. I'm going to tell you what really happened. So I felt like this was an eye-opening privilege to tell this story, not just because it was Candace's story, but because it shines a light on some, you know, much bigger issues. Like Candace's story, her personal story, is this incredible launch pad to discuss some of the real sort of seedy underbelly, underworkings of the American medical system. And that's a lot of what I found, this sort of cutthroat behavior that puts individual sort of achievement and corporate profits really ahead of public health. And that's devastating. And again, to your question, the peptide T story illustrates that even more than the opiate crisis as well. So basically, this was another sort of mind-body thing. The AIDS suddenly, you know, 50,000 men in the U.S. were dying of an unknown cause, essentially. I mean, there were, And there was such incredible bias. And again, I go into this in the book. We don't have to go into the entire political situation. But suffice to say that there was just an incredible prejudice against gay men and an aversion to actually looking at this issue. And even though President Reagan said it was his quote unquote number one health priority, there was zero funding put into this. And as a result, same thing with the opiate crisis. If there's no funding, then no scientists are going to take it up because it's not going to make them famous. They're not going to, it's just that much harder to get grants. Forget it. We don't care. Right. So, if you compare with how Legionnaires' disease was attacked immediately, how, you know, there was a, you know, seven people died of tampering Tylenol bottles around the same time.
And they,
toxic shock syndrome. There were tons that the government mobilized for sort of, those are just three examples of where the government
mobilized.
There was an issue. The government mobilized immediately, you know, money, threw money at it, and it was solved. HIV has sort of an average incubation of 5.5 years, and it was basically left to spread for nearly a decade unabated between the times that scientists started to see and doctors started to see this sort of complex mass of symptoms and when the government actually intervened to do something about it. So this was like 1985, and Candace is working at the NIMH at the time. She sort of rehabilitated her image, like somewhat. She still got her job. And she gets a call from a guy at the National Cancer Institute who's familiar with her work on the mind-body connection. And he said, because the Cancer Institute was sort of spearheading some of the study of AIDS. And he said, we are seeing in AIDS patients symptoms of dementia, you know, that basically we can't figure out how this disease pierces the blood-brain barrier. It affects, you know, could you take a look at this? Maybe it's the sort of the same, because you've studied the connection between the body and the brain. How could a disease, what we think of as a disease of the body, now be infiltrating the brain? So as Candace started to look at this, she saw this unique path forward, because most people at that point, even though she performed her initial mind-body studies like 5 years earlier, most people didn't even believe that they were true. So nobody else was looking at this. Like, people were trying to.
Yeah, they were questioning whether there was even an immune system in the brain. I mean, it's.
Yeah.
It's kind of quite recent research, which is like.
I know. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable, but yes, that's exactly right. And so she set out to try to figure out initially to sort of figure out how AIDS infected the brain. And whether it was possible to sort of, again, using her ideas and her knowledge of receptors, create some sort of a blocker, like a disease, something that would fill that receptor to block the disease from ever getting in. So even if the disease continued to exist in the body, it would have nothing to latch onto and would immediately, you know, or would eventually sort of, or, you know, just die out, right?
Didn't have a host, yeah.
It didn't have a host, exactly. And so that became peptide T. She discovered that, and it was it turned out to be a non-toxic treatment, you know, all natural. So then there was a question of, okay, can you patent it if it's non-toxic? Is it actually a drug, or is it sort of a mimetic? There were a lot of things when she tried to sort of make money off of this, you know, some questions. But up until this point, the only drug that was FDA approved to treat AIDS was AZT, and it had come out of the National Cancer Institute. And boy, is there a story there as well, because different institutes at the NIH were all fighting for, once the government got involved and once people decided that this was important, it was in the press, there was money, suddenly people saw a path to money, power, the Nobel Prize, right? It became a sexy disease, right? And so again, Candace, this rabble-rousing woman, comes in with her own idea. She's, again, stepping on the toes of what she called the body boys. And so what was fascinating is I was doing a lot of my primary research, reading articles from the 1980s at the time, like right in the middle of COVID. So I had started hearing about Tony Fauci 4, 5, 6 years earlier, because he was a contemporary of Candace. They had both won Federal Servants 40 Under 40 awards together. They knew each other decently well. But Tony Fauci at the time was not the Tony Fauci of today, you know, but trust the science. Yeah. He was a very young administrator. He was a rising star. He was the youngest person ever to lead an NIH institute at the age of 43. He was promoted. So Tony Fauci was running the 19-member committee that decided which AIDS drugs would move forward for clinical trials. And you would think that that put him in a big position of power. But in fact, he was dealing with much bigger, you know, bigger swinging, you know what, you know, like much, much bigger egos from the National Cancer Institute, guys who were more senior, more powerful, you know, with allies in the government, allies in business, you know, there was. And so what was interesting to find is on Fauci's committee, there weren't the same biotech laws as there are now. There were people, multiple people with financial interests in competing drugs. So a direct conflict of interest. And what ended up happening to Candace is, again, if you win, I lose, right? So there were people who didn't want Candace to find a cure, much less a natural cure, because it would mess up their deals with pharmaceutical companies.
Exactly.
You can say, because Candace went on to, you know, leave the NIH to form multiple, you know, the first one was a venture-backed company. And then the other ones, you know, had all the other private investors. And unfortunately, in some studies, peptide T worked really well. And in some studies, it maybe didn't. And so there was never a definitive study that proved the efficacy of peptide T. But in fact, no matter what, it was basically...
Yeah. It needed a lot of money. It needed proper trials. But yeah, it didn't have enough of that.
But Candace, I mean, and again, Candace did a lot of things that sabotaged herself. She was, you know, she was a genuinely challenging person for a variety of reasons. And again, we can go into sort of her own issues of mental health. But the reality was, like, what I say is, like, Candace managed to withstand such spectacular gaslighting and such genuine sabotage from her own peers and colleagues that you sort of wonder, you know, everybody, mental health and emotional health is a spectrum for everyone. And
exactly,
I asked the question, like, was she driven insane? If you were constantly being told that you are wrong, that your work is garbage, that you are, you know, and really she was invalidated as a human being. I mean, the trolling and the mocking.
Now, that's going to affect you. I mean, that's a lot of the work that I do, psychoneurobiology. That is, you know, how you are, how what's constantly bombarding you is affecting how you function, mind, brain, and body, because it's all three working together. So definitely my take on her mental health challenges is that she was having normal responses to adverse circumstances, extremely adverse. You can't go for years with the amount of how she stood up to those institutions and to what was wrong. And yes, she did succumb. You know, you tell in your story how there were certain things that she herself did that weren't great. But I often think it was desperation that drove her. Not that you can justify anything that's wrong, but you know, that you start making bad decisions when you've had years of that hammering. So yes, I agree with you. I don't like the fact that she was labeled with a DSM label that's not even scientific. I think that was really just another way of putting her down.
Yeah.
And I just think she was trying to fight a system, and she paid a price.
Yeah. And then there is the feminist angle on this, which says, okay, all of these institutions were set up by men, by white men, to cater to white men's needs. And that doesn't mean that white men are bad. I mean, again, I have three sons, right? So I'm not going to sit up, but it does mean that we need to acknowledge that and then to figure out, okay, what is that? And what are the leadership characteristics that are prized in those environments? Well, they are tough. They are, you know, they are battle worn. They are sneaky. They are dog eat dog. They are, you know, I mean, all of the, you know, the leadership characteristics that are increasingly prized today, I mean, more so in some industries than others. But I mean, you know, we are now looking at words like that are used like empathy, you know, and fairness and things like that. But none of those words were in the vernacular of leadership, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And so what do you do if you are a woman? And this is part of what I studied in Stiletto Network, because it really did tie in. What I found was, I was trying to figure out, while I was telling everybody this love story disguised as a business story about women coming together and supporting each other, I did hear a whole bunch of stories of people saying, oh my gosh, I will never work with a woman again. This person stabbed me in the back, worst boss. And I tried to figure out, like, I don't believe one type of person is bad. I was looking at what are the systemic reasons that lead to different behaviors. And what I found was that if there's only room for one woman or person of color in any given department, if not company or entire industry, you can't share information with the gal in the office next to you, or like shine a light on that talented up and comer, because she's going to knock you off your perch. So that stereotype, you know, came about because women were clinging white knuckled, and so people of color too, to that their tiny patch of power, because there was only room for one. And I think Candace, and in many ways, they sort of when women replicated those male leadership, you know, the capabilities or characteristics, they were, you know, then labeled bitches. You know, so it's like it was a poison pill. Like you couldn't win either way. And I think that's a lot of what happened to Candace was that she, you know, she became a steamroller. She really did. Like she pushed people's buttons and she was incendiary and she was going to do what she was going to do. But, you know, had she been a man at that time,
it would have been
a multiple press.
Yeah, exactly. She would have. If she'd been a male and if she'd been, she would have had all good adjectives attached to her, not, you know, the bitch, the power hungry, the wearing the pants, all these terrible things that have been said, which is, and this is why, you know, not only is the work you do and this book that you've written so important for multiple reasons, and one of Candace's work needs to be recognized. But there's also the work that you're doing for women in general. You know, this is just not right because there's so much that's wrong and it needs to change. And it is changing, but it's a constant fight. And it's these stories and your kind of work that are helping to shine a light on what's happening and encourage women to speak up. You know, this is, I hear these things and I think, thank goodness I didn't go into industry and that I stayed on my own and I have my own company. I'm the president of my own company and I'm lucky I managed to do that. And, but yet it's like, you know, from outside, I haven't had to go directly in and experience what Candace experienced and how so many women experience that, but I have the deepest and utmost sympathy because I know it's happening. And it has to be changed. And, you know, that's, I'm so grateful for you doing the work that you're doing because it's, you know, it's shining a light where there needs to be, where it needs to be shone. And not only with women in the health industry, you know, what is, you know, the privatization of hospitals? What are the worst things that could ever have happened? I mean, that's just like what happened with all these doctors. I know so many fantastic doctors that are battling to practice because they're battling to make a decent living with all their years of experience because of the way the health insurance system is set up and how, you know, you just all of the bad things about that and who are doing other things and they should be doing people that are 25 years in neurosurgery that are leaders in their field leaving. Four of my friends have left. Four people that I know that are brilliant neurosurgeons left the profession, you know, literally three of them left because of these kinds of reasons. And, you know, that's not what healthcare, you know, doctors work hard and study hard and spend a lot of money to get there. They should be rewarded and the industry, the environment should not be an industry. It should be what it initially was supposed to be, which Hippocrates, you know, was trying to make it function as. But anyway, my little bandwagon there, you and I could talk for hours about this.
I know, I couldn't agree more.
I mean, this is just some, I just shake my head and I just, it's just good we have these conversations and there's a lot more I'd love to discuss with you as well. And I'd love to, I think we'll have to do a part two because I think we've touched the tip of the iceberg. I'd love to dive a little more into the sort of industry side of things and what we can do and that kind of thing in another podcast.
Anytime. I love your work. I would love to do that.
That would be amazing. But what I'd love to do now, just sort of wrapping up in the next 5 minutes is I don't want to end off on a negative note about Candace, but I wanted to just talk a little bit more about her story because otherwise, you know, people are becoming more aware because of your book of the other side. And we want to give honor where honor's due, but we also want to show, you know, what can happen. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, a little bit about what happened with, cause you, to Candace in her latter part of her life? And
I think, again, I did not, part of the reason that, you know, initially, again, I got the rights to her book with the intention to make a film about her life. But I said to her, you know, to her widower, her second husband, Michael Ruff, you know, well, hold on a second. Candace's memoir was published in 1997. She passed away in 2013. How does her story end? So my initial process didn't begin with the intention to write another book. It was to sort of just figure out what is the ending to her story. And what I ended up discovering, again, was something I never expected to discover. And it really, and it does cast a shadow on her legacy, you know, but I think also, again, opens the door to much bigger issues about women in science and the scientific establishment.
And why it actually happened.
And, you know, and why this happened to her sort of. And part of what I ask is, you know, one of the lines from the book that I sort of, you know, that I wrote was, you know, what happens when, you know, when standards break down and rules are broken? You know, what happens when the very systems who are supposed to uphold public health are to their core rank with sickness? this. And then I say, what turns a good woman bad? So it's sort of a question of, you know, the trajectory of Candace's life. She ended up, I mean, you know, the short story is she and her second husband ended up in a series of companies and increasingly financially desperate and defrauding investors. And so, and I think with Candace's mental health and emotional health, she was very fragile toward the end of her life. And I think really had the intention, her investors all, you know, it's so funny because people loved her, right? And so, and no one believes, they believe that she was sick and she was desperate. They don't believe that she was malevolent or manipulative. You know, they even people who kind of, you know, you could say that she, you know, she deceived and defrauded, wanted still at the end, want to believe the best of her. So what I sort of hope to do and intend to do, like, is to place her personal story in context of these wider systems that fuel dysfunction and greed. You know, if Candace was taught, like, Candace replicated the behavior of all of these men, like Bob Gallo or whatever at the National Cancer Institute, who, you know, it was widely acknowledged to have stolen HIV, claimed to have discovered that HIV was the root cause of AIDS, and, you know, wanted to claim that for himself. There was this whole international incident where both presidents of both countries had to come together to solve this because he had stolen it from the Pasteur, from scientists at the Pasteur Institute. So you have these men who are Candace's contemporaries, who then go on. He still has an incredible career. He founded, he got kicked out of the NIH, founded the Institute of, you know, Human Virology at the University of Maryland. He's a pillar of his field. And then you have someone like Candace who fought tooth and nail every day of her life. And yeah, she ended up doing some really bad stuff. But the question was, you know, would she ever have done this? Where I like to see that is in, like, context of history. There were so many men of her era and her vintage who were doing the exact same thing and worse, and none of them got punished. And again, what I say is women replicate those behaviors and they inevitably get burned at the stake. Does it mean they're right? No, she was far from a saint. But what are we looking at when that kind of behavior is the norm?
We're looking at a system. Problem. We have to address the core root, like you're saying, like exactly what Candace says and what I say and what the whole mind, brain, body, psychoneurobiology movement is saying is that if you've got something going on in your life, it's not you. It's not that that's not who you are. You're showing up like that because of. And in Candace's situation, that's not who she was. Who she was became distorted. Who she was the scientist who found groundbreaking research who moved through her life. She lived within a system that was totally corrupt. And that started shifting how she was showing up. And she almost fell into that. Well, she did. She fell into almost the same kind of way of functioning to survive.
Increasingly throughout her life, as Candace became more desperate and fragile, she became more open to the energy and attracting these bloodsuckers toward her. People who wanted to, in the spiritual community, who wanted to latch onto her because she provided scientific proof for what they did. People are absolutely legitimate practitioners. Others were sort of people who wanted to make money off of her. Exactly. It's the same thing in the business world. People who, you know, financiers who sort of saw a way to kind of screw the scientist. Oh, she's not going to get the business side. So I'm going to profit, you know, from her brilliance. And, you know, arguably people in her personal life like that too. And so the question is as a mind body person, how do we retain the strength even within these systems to stand up for what we believe in and have enough self love? And that's sort of the part that I find, you know, really hard about Candace's story, because always I just wanted to say, I mean, I'm so close with her family now. I'm like, they loved her so much. I wish she had loved herself as much as other people loved her.
That's amazing. What a way to end this, and what a way to initiate the next discussion, because that's a whole discussion on our own. So Pamela, thank you. This has been so amazing. And I'm just so glad I've met you, and I'm just so glad you do the work that you do.
It's an honor. I'm so happy to meet you.
I'm really excited, and I know this is not the end. This is just the beginning. And thank you for joining us today. And I'm really looking forward to part 2, 3, 4 and wherever this goes. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I hope you found today's podcast interesting and helpful. If you want more tips and help with managing anxiety, depression, and mental health, be sure to visit my website at drleaf.com. And to sign up for my weekly newsletter,
where I also include a schedule of my speaking events and so much more. And follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just look for Dr. Caroline Leaf. Also, I love seeing all your posts on social media about this podcast. I love seeing what resonates with you and what you've learned. So be sure to continue posting and tagging me and letting me know what you think and how these tips worked out for you. And don't forget, leave a review and keep spreading the word about this podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I really hope you learned something new and helpful. Till then, I'm Dr. Caroline Leaf. This podcast represents the opinions of myself and my guest. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. The content here is for educational and informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional for any individual medical questions you may have. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors.